The life of 19th century London preacher Charles Haddon Spurgeon is a life worthy of the big screen. Everything about him seems to be larger than life. His preaching gift, his booming voice, his wit, and of course, his waistline. He was called the Prince of Preachers, and between his first sermon and his final sermon is 40 years and 9 months of pulpit and publishing productivity that remains unrivaled in church history. But in those over 40 plus years of ministry, I find myself drawn to one particular period, and that period is his first 5 years of ministry, starting with his unexpected conversion to Christ in January of 1850. Spurgeon was converted at age 15. He preached his first sermon not long after he turned 16. He took his first pastorate at age 18, and he finally found an open door and a welcoming pastorate in the city of London at age 19 in the year 1854. The shape of these first 5 years between 1850 and 1854 is as dramatic as it is unlikely and almost unbelievable. And to talk more about Spurgeon's first 5 years of ministry, I contacted two scholars. A little later, we'll talk with Christian George. But first, we talk with Dr. Tom Nettles, the professor of historical theology at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He's also the author of a forthcoming book titled Living by Revealed Truth, The Life and Pastoral Theology of Charles Haddon Spurgeon, which is published by Christian Focus. The book is part biography and part evaluation of the pastoral theology of Spurgeon that he developed in his preaching. The book will be released in the UK in July and in the United States in September. Living by Revealed Truth covers the span of Spurgeon's entire ministry, but I put Dr. Nettles on the line to give us a historical thumbnail sketch of these eventful first few years between 1850 and 1854, Spurgeon's first 5 years of ministry. This is what he said.
Of course, he was converted in January of 1850. Everyone knows the great story of that, how he couldn't go to the accompany his father to his preaching place because of a snowstorm, and he was depressed, and he went into the town there where he attended the Artillery Street Primitive Methodist Church in Colchester, and he heard this man preach and point him to Christ. He tells the story many times during his sermons. There are always little nuances that come out that sort of give you a fuller picture, but nevertheless, he looked to Christ. He was converted and immediately began to plunge himself into work for the gospel. He already had a mature concept of what the gospel was. This was not like necessarily a novice jumping into these things because he had been trained so well in his grandfather's home and by his father and by his mother, had been prayed with, had been exhorted, had already been drawing judgments about what was good preaching and what was not good preaching, even when he was in an unconverted state. And so when he was converted, the Lord used all of these things and brought them together so that Spurgeon had a high degree of maturity from the very beginning, both in theology and his knowledge of biblical truth. So he began to work at a Sunday school. Of course, he was baptized soon. He decided on his reading of the scripture that his paedobaptism was not sufficient, was not biblical, and so he was baptized as a believer. But then he began to work in the Sunday school at Cambridge, and his abilities began to become well known there, and so he was sort of a lead teacher. He would teach the teachers on Sunday afternoon before they would go and teach their students, and also, then he became involved as a lay preacher with the Lay Preaching Association. He began to be sent out to different places. The first sermon he preached was at Teversham, and the man who sent him out, sort of in a clever way, didn't let Spurgeon know that he was the one preaching, thought he was going to be accompanying someone else. And then Spurgeon found out that the other person had no intent of preaching at all, and the man accompanying him suggested that he just do one of his Sunday school lessons. And so his first sermon was on 1 Peter 2:7 about the preciousness of Christ. After that, he began to preach regularly. And in 1851, he was called to one of the churches where he had preached. He was called to the Water Beach Church. And the Water Beach was a town with about 1,300 residents. He was 17 years old when he went there. His ministry was so successful that there were around 20 or 25 when he first went, and then there were eventually over 450 within 2 years. Everyone in the town knew him. He he describes the town as being pretty given over to, well, crime and to drinking and to just sort of a dissolute lifestyle. But there was, this was greatly changed by the regular preaching they had there. He has several descriptions of it in some of his sermons. I don't distrust Spurgeon on it. I think I find him to be such a refreshingly honest and transparent person that I don't think he's exaggerating at all in, when he talks about the transformation that took place. While he was there, he came to the attention of several people. On one occasion, he spoke at a Sunday school convention where he was reprimanded by one of the attendants at the Sunday school convention for his youth, and he said he ought to let his beard grow, and Spurgeon got up and said, well, if you're talking about the occasion where the Jewish men were embarrassed and had their beards shaded, this was something that was because of a particular debility in their own character that this had happened. And so little he didn't know that the man who had reprimanded him actually had a character flaw that soon came out. But his boldness there brought him to the attention of some other people that had attended the convention. And led eventually to an invitation to go to London. But he also became known to a man named Pato Brown, who was a very strong Finneyite. He was an Arminian, and he had sponsored Finney coming to London, coming to England. But he heard Spurgeon preach, and so he invited him to preach in the church where Pato Brown was a member, and then spent the afternoon debating theology with him. And became a friend of Spurgeon, even though he never changed his theology, and Spurgeon called it an afternoon of felicitous misery, and also told Pato Brown that his theology was just worthless theology. He came to the attention of Joseph Angus, who was a principal of the Baptist College, and Angus was going to be preaching in Cambridge, and so he invited Spurgeon to come and meet with him on Monday. And the story is well known as to how Spurgeon was led into one room by the maid and Angus led into the other room by the maid, and she didn't tell either one of them that the other was there. Finally, Angus had to leave, but he left a note for Spurgeon to meet him at some point. Spurgeon was thinking about this, and as he was leaving the home, and it was the home of the very wealthy publisher named Macmillan, he was walking across Midsummer Commons, and then, of course, people normally know the story also as to how he was contemplating his future and whether he should get education. And he says it was as if he had heard a voice from heaven saying, "Seekest thou great things for thyself, seek them not." And he determined that he would stay with preaching at the Water Beach, and he would educate himself through his own study and through the practical ministry of pastoral work. And now, this didn't mean that he disliked education, of course, because he established a pastor's college, but that was his own guidance. And so he stayed there longer, and then in the fall of 1853, he got a note from the church, New Park Street Church in London, asking him to come preach. He thought it was a mistake. He thought it must be for his cousin that lived in a different county. But his deacon that had the letter assured him, "No, it's for you." The people at Water Beach knew they couldn't keep him long because they could see that he was so really extraordinarily talented, as well as earnest and intense and attractive in the pulpit. They just knew he wouldn't stay there. So he finally consented to go and preach in London. It was a very intimidating experience for him in the evening before, but when he got there and preached, he really... he admits a perversity in what comforted him. The congregation seemed so small and so insignificant. He thought that, well, surely this is not something above me yet. So we had a pretty good morning. We went back in the evening, and the congregation was at least double the size. And he preached again out of Revelation about the way the saints appear before the throne of God appear. Cleansed by the blood of Christ. And they issued an invitation for him to come for 6 months, and he said, "No, make it 3 months, because then I can either drop it or you can drop it if we both see it's not going to work." But after 3 months, they issued an invitation for him. And then for the next 2 years, he's preaching, and the church grows so much that they have to expand it. And so by 1855, the church has to be expanded, and he begins his The first sermon in the new Park Street pulpit was published in January of 1855.
So much more could be said. Thank you for that. Back up to the very first sermon that Spurgeon preaches in the fall of 1850. He kind of got duped into it in the first place, and he can hardly get through the sermon, this first sermon, because people cannot believe that a 16-year-old could preach as well as he did, and people wanted to interrupt and ask him how old he was. It seems even as a teenager then, Spurgeon was very self-aware of his own gifting, that it was going to require a lot of work to get people's attention on Christ and not to be enamored by this teenage preaching phenom.
He could tell very soon that people responded well to his teaching, even when he was just doing Sunday school. And he confesses that most of the things that he's done, he was pressed into it by Providence. It's not because he sought it, but people sought him out and pressed him into it. But he always felt a degree of not only of obligation, but of graciousness in it. And he knew every point of his life was one of grace. And that God had given him convictions and had given him gifts beyond what other people were able to do. I think he recognized that very early when they began to want him to teach the Sunday school. And of course, you're talking about the event when he first preached there at the Tabernacle, I think is where the first sermon was, and he was preaching on the preciousness of Christ, and this lady interrupted him and said, "Bless your heart, how old are you?" And he says, "Well, it's not time to discuss that right now. We need to speak about the preciousness of Christ." And so she reissued a question after that, and all he could say was, "Well, I'm less than 60." And she responded, "Yes, and less than 16. But he was, I mean, they recognize, we attempt to make a hagiography out of our discussion of Spurgeon because there's so many things that are remarkable about him. And I want to avoid that, but I tend to believe what he says, as I said earlier, because he's so transparent about other things, about his depression, about his suffering, about the difficulties at times that he has of getting in the pulpit. And that transparency leads me to believe when he's talking about these other issues. And so I think, just to get back to your question, is I think that he was aware that he had extraordinary gifts. It seems that he, in his letters to his father, he said, "I'm already a preacher. I'm already have a big congregation." When he had his Waterbeats congregation was up over 400, he said, "My own study says what I hear other people preach. I know that they're not as good as me. They don't preach sermons that I think that are very compelling." But it was not like he was glorying in raw talent. He knew that God had prepared him. He felt a deep indebtedness to grace all along, and knew that this was something that God had prepared him for.
I don't know what else would explain it. And in your book, you write Spurgeon preached 600 times in the first 2 years of his preaching ministry. That's incredible. I mean, how is this possible? Was he preaching every day? Was he recycling sermons? What did this look like?
Well, he wrote his father one time when he was talking. His father was talking to him about wanting him to go to college, and he had decided not to. And he said, and he was talking about how his education was practical in his preaching. And he says a line in one of the letters, he says, "I'm preaching every night." And so he was preaching at least twice on Sunday, and the church congregation wanted to preach again in the evening. He was preaching morning, afternoon. They wanted to preach in the evening, and he told them, "Well, listen, I'm just young. I'm not as strong as a man. I can't preach three times every Sunday." But he did sometime. But he continued, while he was at Water Beach, he was continuing also with the Lay Preachers Association, going to other places. And so he could have been preaching as many as six times, 6 days every week, and then a couple of times on Sunday. And so he easily would have preached 300 times during a year for 2 years.
And how many original sermons would this represent, do you think?
Well, I know that he did preach sermons again. I've not done any detailed study as to how many times he would preach one particular sermon, but he would preach a sermon. He would use it in the sword and trowel. Then he would preach a sermon the same sermon again at a conference where he had been invited to preach. He would preach sermons in his congregation. Then he would do an outdoor meeting where he had maybe thousands of people there. So I don't know how many times it would be the same sermon, but I find him amazingly productive in the number of different sermons that he preaches. In fact, later he talks about, after he begins to publish his sermons in 1855, he said how hard it was. He says, everybody else can use their sermons more than once because they're not being printed. One, I preach one and they're printed and I can't ever use them again. He says, I've got to come up with something new every time. And really, it was something he enjoyed doing, but he was very candid about the difficulties that created for him and having to come up with something new virtually every time he preached because it was either being printed in the newspaper or reported in the newspaper or printed in the penny pulpit, and then it would come out monthly in the other avenues of publication, and then yearly come out in the Metropolitan Tabernacle and New Park Street pulpit. And so there was hardly an unpublished thought that Spurgeon had. He had to continually churn out new things.
Yeah, his productivity is incredible. And with all your experience studying Spurgeon's life and ministry, what most surprises you about his development in these first 5 years of ministry?
I would say that Spurgeon had a maturity in theology and biblical exposition and application born out of years of struggle with personal sin before his conversion that immediately was usable in his exposition. You can take a sermon in 1855 and a sermon in 1890 and look at them, and the nature of his insight in 1855 and of the power and passion of his theology would be virtually unchanged. Now, some would complain, say, well, that shows he didn't grow any. Well, no, I mean, any person who spent time reading Spurgeon's sermons just year after year after year knows that there's always something brilliant and scintillating in every sermon from the earliest to the latest. And it's not because he didn't grow in it, it's because he had such maturity from the beginning. People can read those early sermons and just find in them things that are astounding. As Packer begins his book on knowing God with a quote from a sermon Spurgeon did, I think when he was 21, about the power of knowing God. A beautiful, absolutely wonderful quote. Packer considered it worthy of opening up his whole book, Knowing God, with that quote from Spurgeon. So the maturity, I think that's what I would point to, is the intensity of theological and applicatory maturity in Spurgeon in those early days.
Yeah, and you talk about the years of struggles that Spurgeon experiences in the book, but for us here, explain for us a little bit more about this pre-conversion struggle that shaped him so deeply.
Yeah, Spurgeon has a vivid memory of what all that was like. He talks about how he resisted the call of God, and he resisted sermons. He talked about the subject matter of sermons and how he would not do what the text said. The text would say, come to Jesus. He wouldn't come to Jesus. The text would warn him of impending doom, and he would push it out of his mind. The text would talk about the attractiveness of Christ, and he would consider it an imposition on his life. And just everything, he just describes how his mind rejected every admonition that he heard in sermons. And then he talks about this massive oppression of the law, and he has these vivid images about the plows being pulled by 10 black horses or something across his back, making furrows, and he talks about the 10 devils coming and assaulting his mind after he had a carnal repentance or something, but did not receive Christ. He just has these very powerful images about the greatness of his conviction and the how much he deserved hell. He's very clear about eternal punishment and that God could have cast him off. And finally, though, the thing that saved him was that encounter there in the Primitive Methodist Chapel, but he immediately began to talk about it as an effectual calling, how the power of God overwhelmed and overcame all of his objections, and that no less power than an omnipotent grace is needed to convert a person. He knows that if it had not been for invincible grace and God's I wills, that he would never have been brought to a place of saying, I will. I think it's in volume one of his autobiography where he talks about this, and then, of course, it punctuates his sermons, his own personal testimony. He just feels the kind of conviction he had. But I think it deserves to be put within the framework of literature of something like Augustine's Confessions and Bunyan's Grace Abounding to the Chief of sinners. And so all of these Luther's struggle with his own self-righteousness and his inability to find peace with God, and then Spurgeon's testimony about this. All of this gives a broad spectrum of the kinds of struggles that saints have had through the year with through the years with a sense of their own sinfulness, until finally brought into the freedom of the gospel by a special operation of grace.
That was Dr. Tom Nettles, professor of historical theology at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, and the author of a forthcoming book titled Living by Revealed Truth, The Life and Pastoral Theology of Charles Haddon Spurgeon, published by Christian Focus, and to be released in the UK in July and in the US in September. Another scholar interested in Spurgeon's first 5 years of ministry is a theologian and author by the name of Christian George. Dr. George currently serves as the Jewel and Joe L. Hewitt Assistant Professor of Religious Education at Oklahoma Baptist University. He is particularly interested in the first 5 years of Spurgeon's ministry because a few years back he discovered 11 handwritten journals containing Spurgeon's earliest thoughts and sermon outlines from the period immediately before and after his conversion. George is now transcribing these previously unpublished journals to get them published and make them more widely available. I began by asking him how he discovered the journals.
It was during my last year of PhD work in St. Andrews, Scotland. I was doing a PhD on Charles Spurgeon's Christology. I was interested in looking at how Spurgeon communicated Christ. And my research took me down to London, to Spurgeon's College in South London. And as I was working in the archives, the librarian, a woman by the name of Judy Powles, directed my attention to a stack of journals, no bigger than 8x10. And I remember, Tony, looking down at the journals and saying to myself, this is nothing less than Spurgeon's earliest handwritten unpublished sermons, laying dormant for over 160 years. Spurgeon himself, I found out, had sought to publish them in 1857. He was intending to revise them and to provide them perhaps in one of the commentaries, He was wanting to revise them and put them in his Metropolitan Tabernacle Pulpit series. The interesting thing is that Spurgeon, according to Susanna, his wife, never got around to it. He was in a high-pressure job. He had moved from the country in Essex to the big city of London. A cholera outbreak in 51 had decimated the city. And so for 160 years, these journals have been forgotten in time. Spurgeon would have published them and never got around to it. So for the past 2.5 years, I've been working intimately with these documents, preparing them for publication, reading Spurgeon. It's a bit like a theological grail hunt, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, and much of these journals are sermon outlines. Would Spurgeon have preached sermons from these journals, or what are you seeing?
Well, of course, this project is still in its infancy. There are three stages, the transcription, the analysis, and then the publication stage. So I'm still in the transcription stage of the game. But from what I can tell, to answer your question, Spurgeon wrote these brief skeletons, some of them are longer, beforehand, and then took them with them into the pulpits of these little thatched cottages and churches and preached from these manuscripts, from these handwritten documents.
And it's not just sermons. I mean, what else are you finding in these journals?
Well, they're quite amazing. And one of the challenges that I'm finding myself encountering is that there are so many of them, 1,395 pages of journals, handwritten, every one of them. Some of the handwritten journals are almost unrecognizable, waterlogged. You can only imagine what Spurgeon was doing with them as he was taking them on, as he walked miles and miles to these little villages around Cambridge. We have not only sermon journals, we have bird drawings. We have things like French prayers, things that are not typically associated with the young Spurgeon. We have a number of personal entries. We have journals. Diary entries from this time. What's really interesting about I think these journals is that they are a political commentary. They show so much of what was going on in the world during that time. Spurgeon talks about the politics of his day. He talks about the wars of his day, not just the theology that meant so very much to him in his early life. What's really interesting, what I just about fell out of my chair when I came across, was a sermon called The Talents, preached on September the 10th, 1849, which Tony is actually a year before he was even converted. It shows us, I think, that Spurgeon, even before God had opened his eyes to his own calling, was doing theology. He was doing exegesis. You would just have to say that God, even before Spurgeon became a Christian, was equipping Spurgeon for this ministry he would later give himself to.
And I know a lot of these early sermons are just in outline form. How many of the sermons are fully written out? Are there any of them that are manuscripted?
Yes, volume 7 through 9 contain the longest sermons that we currently have in Spurgeon scholarship. Most of the early ones are just outlines, just skeletons. The longer ones are word for word written out, which is very unique in Spurgeon scholarship because, as you know, in 1854, Spurgeon begins publishing his New Park Street pulpit commentary series, preaching series, and at that point he spelled out everything, he wrote out everything, but before that we don't have many handwritten manuscripts from Spurgeon.
You spent now 3 years in these early sermons. At this stage in your research, what do you think these early journals are going to provide the world about Spurgeon's early years?
What's interesting, I think, about these early journals is that they show that Spurgeon is developing his theology and his preaching style. We often think of Spurgeon in 1854 as arriving on the scene of London in polished form, but we can't assume this any longer because we're discovering now a preacher whose exegesis and his rhetoric and his theological emphases and his homiletical method were evolving dynamically in these journals over the first 5 years of his ministry. Here is a preacher, Tony, who is trying to make sense of his context while responding to the call that he feels to proclaim his convictions. And it's so fascinating to be able to see Spurgeon evolving, scratching through an idea and polishing it, reworking it, not only grammatically and stylistically, but also in the very theology of the thing. So that's been one of the interesting discoveries that I've come across lately. Of course, there's so much information to work with. I imagine this will occupy my time for quite some time.
Yes, it sounds like you have your hands full. When I read Spurgeon, it's pretty obvious that allegory seems to be a part of his thinking and his preaching. Was this true from what you see in the early journals? Was this part of him from the very beginning?
Well, some scholars have said that Spurgeon was the best of the Puritans or the last of the Puritans. This was true, of course. Spurgeon, when he was a young child, found himself in his grandfather's attic in Stanburn reading the Puritans. His grandfather was an independent Congregationalist pastor who had this library in this very dark attic, and Spurgeon would go up to this attic and he would open books like John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. And he would open books that were just filled with allegorical tendencies. The Puritans were people who allegory was second nature for. And so Spurgeon, from a very pivotal young age, very impressionable age, inundated himself with these works. And I think it had a profound influence on his life. I think it was for this reason, primarily Pilgrim's Progress, that he read over 100 times in his life. That allegory became such a reflex, such an impulse for this young preacher. Spurgeon's own use of his own life, his own stories, was so compelling in these days. And that's how he appropriated the Puritan form of allegory. Allegory in Victorian England was not very prominent. Any Christian family worth their salt, of course, would have had the Bible and also the Pilgrim's Progress on their mantle. But as far as a literary device, from what I've researched, allegory had started to die. And so Spurgeon comes along. He would become the most popular preacher in the Victorian world. And he uses allegory second nature. He almost can't help himself, Tony. There's a tension that emerges in Spurgeon. He wants to allegorize, especially in these early journals, but he often catches himself and he reins himself in, sticking to the literal interpretation of the text. And this tension, it reverberates throughout his ministry. It echoes throughout his ministry, even up until 1892, some of his last sermons, when compared to his very first, still reveal this tension in his text.
Preaching from bare outlines as an early preacher, as a teenager, I mean, he must have had a lot of confidence in his verbal creativity on his feet.
I think so. Of course, he had a photographic memory, which didn't hurt anything. His brother said that he had a deep capacity for remembering, and not only for remembering, not only for regurgitating information, but for making connections. And so when he digests the Holy Bible, everything in his life, it's like he put on God lenses. Everything he saw, he could find a spiritual connection to. And so if he's preaching, I was reading the other day a sermon by Spurgeon. He was preaching in Dover, and there's this prison beneath the church he was preaching in. He changes what he was originally going to preach on that morning, and he preaches about the prison of sin and how we are all prisoners, as Paul says in Romans, chained to our old nature, our old desires. And so Spurgeon is able to appropriate Christ and to appropriate the gospel of Christ in a way that everyone could understand.
Yeah, he did that well. And as you process these 11 journals, are you noticing any changes or any development in his early theology?
Well, one of the interesting things about Spurgeon is that his theology does not change. If you compare some of his earliest sermons to his latest sermons, the content of his theology does not change. What's interesting is that the style and the maturity does change. In these early sermons, in these early skeletons, we have a Spurgeon who is doing a lot of scratching out. He's doing a lot of polishing. He's doing a lot of reworking. And it shows us, it suggests to us that he's in process. It shows to us that his theology about God, his theology of the church, his ecclesiology, his pneumatology, all of these remained unchanged, virtually unchanged until he died in 92. The way, of course, he later articulates these theologies did experience and did undergo some evolution.
I asked this question of Dr. Nettles earlier in the podcast, but I want to ask you the same question. As a newly converted teenager, Spurgeon is clearly aware that people know he's a preaching phenom. I mean, this is not a secret. Are there any indications in those 11 journals that Spurgeon is aware of his gifting, any evidence of a struggle with pride?
You know, that's a very good question, because Spurgeon, again, a man of paradox, deeply humbled, and yet God raised him up. He raised him up to be a man who would publish more words in the English language than any Christian author living or dead. So the question arises, is the early Spurgeon humble, or does he have to battle this sense of pride? From what I can tell, Tony, from what my research has rendered thus far, Spurgeon is a deeply humble teenager. He's aware that he has gifts, and I think consciously he knows that. He knows that God has equipped him for this very unique ministry, but he never flaunts it. He never goes overboard with himself. Even his stories in journals 1 and 2 of himself are very self-deprecating, never lifting himself up, never honoring himself. And so you can see that later in his ministry, particularly after the great Surrey Garden Music Hall disaster, when he begins of course, he's struggling with depression, but he begins to tell stories of his youth. So I think even the old Spurgeon knew the young Spurgeon was nothing without his Savior.
Well said, and I aspire to the humility of the 16-year-old Spurgeon himself. And speaking of the journals, I mean, what's next for these 11 journals? Where are you at in the process of bringing them to publication?
Of course, the project is still in its infancy. It needs maturity, but I am working quickly and I'm working carefully to bring these to publication. As far as deadlines, I have not yet found a publisher for this work. I want it to be the right publisher. Spurgeon, I believe, would want me to publish these journals, not only for the academy, but also for the church. You know, Spurgeon's always doing that. He's always incarnating theology in a way that the commonest, lowest, most humble milkmaid, as Luther would say, could understand. He's really following the impulse of the Reformation. And so I want to follow that example and publish this for the church. And so perhaps there will be a critical, analytical edition of this text alongside of just the plain text, so pastors and lay people can read Spurgeon the way I think Spurgeon should be read. I am only about 30% done with this project. After the transcription phase, there will be an analytical phase, an analysis phase, where I'll compare Spurgeon not only to his other writings, the other journals, but also to the later Spurgeon to see how exactly Spurgeon changed and how pivotal and important these journals are to showing who Spurgeon was and what he believed.
That was Christian George, an author, theologian, and the Jewel and Joe L. Hewitt Assistant Professor of Religious Education at Oklahoma Baptist University. Thanks to Dr. George, we have bird drawings and we have a sermon outline for you to see from these early journals, which he graciously provided for us so that we can post them online. Those have been posted online with the blog post related to this podcast, so be sure to check that out at desiringgod.org. In the search bar, you can search for the blog post title, which is Spurgeon's First 5 Years in Ministry. Take a look at that. Thank you for listening to this fun Spurgeon-themed episode of the Authors on the Line podcast. This free podcast is supported, produced, and distributed by Desiring God in Minneapolis. You can subscribe and find a full archive of episodes by searching for Authors on the Line in the iTunes store or watch for new episodes online at desiringgod.org/blog. I'm your host, Tony Ranke. Thanks for listening.